Well, you can call him a shapeshifter, but that'll be tomorrow, George. Tonight, of course, it is our investment school. That's what we do on a Tuesday. Good. Everyone on the same page? Excellent. Peter Hundersmark is a fund manager at Flagship Asset Management. He thought I was going to get all personal with him. He must have broken into a small sweat. But are you used to small sweats, I'm sure, Peter? You've been traveling around the world, I don't know, for the last 15 years, investing in emerging markets as an investment class. Have you been a glutton for punishment, or has it been quite a fulfilling 15 years?
Hi, Bruce. It's been rewarding, but there have been some hard lessons learned, and I think that's really what I'd like to share a little bit today, the things that you should watch out for.
Okay, so I'm very, very keen to learn your lessons. When we talk about emerging markets as a class, just give me a sense of what that is nowadays.
So we're talking about countries such as Mexico, Colombia, Argentina. We're talking about Turkey, Russia, India, and China, and then all the host of small Asian countries.
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt there because, you know, whenever anybody puts China into emerging markets, I go, but it's an emerged market. It is the world's second biggest economy. Mm. And we still refer to it as an emerging market. And, you know, Russia, for all of its foibles and weirdness, is also, once the epicenter of a global superpower. Why do we class these countries as emerging markets? What is the reason for it?
So that's a good question. There's a variety of human development indicators that you look at in terms of GDP per capita, poverty levels, and things like that, that separate developed countries from emerging markets. And I guess the lesson there a little bit is although these countries have emerged a little bit, as you mentioned, there are still streaks behind developed countries, which obviously haven't stood still while China was emerging. And another thing that you do talk about when you talk about emerging markets is the strength of their institutions. So, you know, you talk about, China being emerged, but 20 years ago, you know, this country was closed to the world, far more closed than it is today. In GDP per capita was less than South Africa's and all. You know, so there's still a fragility and an embryonic state there that is, still emerging.
I love the way you just said, well, 20 years ago, China's GDP was less than South Africa's. And we forget that. And we forget that through deliberate action and deliberate process and deliberate decision making and action, you can turn around the fortunes of a country. and China is the prime example of that.
It really is. And it's quite impressive. And that's understating of what they've been able to achieve there. But I think your words there are correct. You know, you really need intention. You really need to put the right people and the right policies in place. These things don't happen by accident.
No, they most certainly don't. So what have you learned over the last 15 years of traveling around the world? I mean, I could break it into maybe macroeconomics actually does matter, doesn't it? I mean, you can be a brilliant business, but in a dysfunctional environment, and actually nobody's going to want to invest in you.
Absolutely. I think one of the key considerations, you know, most of your listeners will have investments in global funds, and those global funds are taking positions in emerging markets, either through direct investments in those countries, or they have positions that they bought in other countries that have revenues coming from emerging markets. So I guess, the statement there, most of these emerging markets that I mentioned are geopolitically and macroeconomically fragile relative to developed markets. So if you look at what these countries can do with their, the two major tools you have, which is, your fiscal policy and your monetary policy, they are far more constrained in terms of what they can achieve and how they can combat, headwinds that occur, either, commodity prices or interest rates or inflation. They're just far more constrained in what they can achieve. So that's the first big lesson, is that macroeconomically, if you're trying to invest in a country like, for example, Turkey or Brazil, you really need to understand, for example, that Turkey imports a whole bunch of its oil. It's very dependent on its export sector. You need to have a really good macroeconomic view of that country. And similarly, Brazil, you need to understand the role that, soft and hard commodities play in its export balance. You need to understand the psychological impact that inflation has had there and the policies that they put in place to combat that. There's a lot going on in these countries you need to really take a hard look at.
How would you categorize South Africa in that mix? Because, of course, we are one of them.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, South African investors, I think, are quite adept at understanding, you know, what happens in emerging markets, because, you know, macroeconomically, we understand that, you know, our interest rates, if we raise them, then our currency becomes a bit more attractive. We understand that, you know, the funding of our government comes from issuing bonds, and there's a price attached to that in terms of how we conduct ourselves as a country macroprudentially. So there's a lot of learnings that South Africans in terms of understanding inflation can carry across to other emerging markets. So I actually think there's quite a number of good South African investors that you know, have done quite well investing in emerging markets.
Is there a culture of investing in emerging markets? And I mean, if you are in South Africa and you are subject to Regulation 28, I wonder whether you should be investing in other emerging markets. And perhaps you should be, because China is growing and that's great. But just how much more exposure you should have to emerging markets when you're in one? And you know, we see so much boom and bust mentality when it comes to the approach to emerging markets. Is that a cultural thing?
It's absolutely true, but you must remember, you know, you're not going to escape emerging markets. Whether you think you're investing in developed markets, you know, many will think, you know, Anheuser-Busch or Heineken or BAT or whatever. You know, these big conglomerates are getting a large chunk of their revenue from emerging markets. They're getting a large chunk of their earnings, and most importantly, for a lot of them, it's a large chunk of their growth. So the investment case for many of the stocks that are in you know, most of your listeners' global funds does hinge on emerging markets. So you need to learn to price those revenue streams. You need to learn to price the risk, you know, and the return that is coming out of countries like Brazil, like Turkey, like Russia, like China. And you know, I've lumped them all together as emerging markets, but they are very distinct, and each one has separate risks. Now, we've obviously seen a lot about and heard a lot about China recently, and I'll touch on that a little bit later when we talk about regulation. But the you know, the risks there, you know, have really come to the fore in terms of how they're conducting themselves as a nation. And you know, I spoke a bit earlier about Turkey needing to understand the balance of how they import and what's impacting their economy, and Russia is the same.
Culturally, sorry, as well. I mean, Turkey, for goodness sake. I mean, the president keeps firing members of the central bank, and he wonders why his bond market and currency markets are in such turmoil. There is just no sort of semblance of independence.
Yeah, you know, I think culturally, what's important for me to understand when I'm investing is, you know, we sit in South Africa and we, you know, your dad made money out of shares. Your grandfather probably had shares. There's a real culture of equity ownership, and it sits, you know, it's embedded in how we believe wealth should be created. And that's quite a Western way of thinking. And it manifests in our pension funds and in our savings. So we all hold stocks, and you know, I'm here talking on you know, a money show where we're talking about, equities and investing. But, you know, there's a decidedly different take on that in many emerging markets. So there's not such an entrenched culture of equities. The listed space in India or in Turkey or in Mexico or in Russia is not nearly what it is in developed markets. You know, there's no culture of, you know, equities is the way I'm going to preserve or grow wealth. So, you know, if you use Turkey as an example, it's been a frightfully dull market in terms of listings or mergers or acquisitions. It's really not an equity-friendly culture. Most of the businesses listed there are holding companies, and that's just because the owners decided to liquidate or exit their structures. But you're right. You know, you need to invest in countries where there's a cultural support for equities, and that manifests in their savings and pension industry.
And that regulatory environment that you referred to a moment ago, and we've seen a huge change, and maybe it wasn't a change, maybe it was just a tightening up. I'm not too sure how you interpret it. But from our perspective, we've just seen the destruction of the values of Prosus and Naspers as a result of a change of tone in China when it comes to digital companies. And of course, Prosus and Naspers together own 30% of Tencent, which is a massively probably too successful a Chinese company.
So, you know, Bruce, I think that's a good example. You know, China has been very topical lately because of the change in regulation that they have published. I think the lesson there is quite frankly that emerging markets and particularly China, they have a different agenda. You know, in the West, you know, we would look at, or at least up until like 5-6 years ago, you would look at, you know, capitalism and the pursuit of wealth and growth to be almost sacrosanct. And those are the goals of society, and there's sacrifices that are made to achieve those goals. And in China, it's different. They're willing to make different sacrifices to achieve different goals. You know, so that's really, you know, if you approach it from a view that, you know, things should be like the US or things should be like Europe or even South Africa, you know, you're going to lose money. You need to understand that, you know, that society is trying to achieve different things than what you may think is valuable. So, you know, you look at what they did in the education space. You know, the desire at the moment is to achieve, you know, a population growth. And because of that, you need to have a more affordable education. And so that's something that they see as a market failure. And you know, the Communist Party is going to step in and make it more affordable. You know, that's how they roll. And I think, you know, that's coming to that local knowledge. You need to understand that.
But there is so much to understand, and so much of what we think we understand, we have absolutely no clue about because of just the substantially different approach in so many markets, and particularly when it comes to China. I mean, sitting, you know, 10,000 miles away from Beijing, there is absolutely no way that you can unless you spend an awful lot of time there and really assimilate it. I don't know if you can fully understand the approach the Chinese take to managing that economy.
I think the best approach is to start out very humble and just to say, look, you know. And I think the smartest approach is to say, I don't know, but these are the things that I would like to know. And I think if you approach it from that angle, it's far wiser than coming in and saying, well, this has been my experience, and this is the experience of you know, the developed markets, which, of course, everyone is now gravitating towards. And therefore, you know, surely China and everyone else will you know, will come to the same conclusion, and everyone will, you know, become homogenistic and the same. You know, I think if you approach it rather from a perspective that, you know, China is an ancient society that thinks very long term, they have, as I said, different goals in what they want to achieve. And you should approach that with a little bit of humility and say, well, you know, let's understand it. And once I understand it, I'll invest in the areas that I believe, you know, hold, you know, the same societal goals and have the same outcomes that they want to achieve. You know, that's unfortunately how that market works. You know, and it's not alone. Russia is the same. You know, you need to understand that this is a style of government that is not familiar to most Westerners. You know, Brazil, you need to understand that they've only had a central bank really for 20 years. They've only had, you know, anything longer than a 5-year bond since 2007. You know, these institutions and these countries are you know, they're children compared to, you know, the Western countries. And I'm not saying that they will grow up to be the same either. They will grow up to be different countries, different identities. And China is a very good example of that.
Yeah, I mean, and we've just, you know, there's a huge amount of arrogance, I think, in the world of investing sometimes, and we kind of think that everybody should, you know, think the way we do and behave the way we do. And we make the assumption that things will continue in a straight line, and they very seldom do, if ever, when it comes to the world of investing.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the China situation we've seen now is a very good wake-up call for managers that have invested, you know, with the wrong pretense or with the wrong idea. And there's been a sort of consensus, nice, warm and fuzzy consensus that, well, you know, China will slowly open up and everyone will understand the benefits of being part of, you know, the global community and so on and so forth. And everything will remain just fine. And there's nice and solid growth there. But, you know, I think things are far more complicated, and you really need to delve into descend into the detail to understand what's happening in these countries and what their societies want to achieve. Because ultimately, as an investor, those are things you need to understand. They form, you know, part of the mosaic.
And currencies. I mean, if ever there was a level of paranoia, it's being exposed to developing market currencies, emerging market currencies.
Bruce, I must say this is one of the more difficult areas, and I've actually, you know, if I talk about the five things you must watch out for, currency stands out on its own because it's so important, and it really means that if you're going to move out of the natural hunting grounds, let's say, of most global investors, which is United States, Europe, and Japan, if you're going to move into an emerging market, you really need to understand the vulnerabilities of that currency. You need to understand where you are in that country's cycle, you know, its economic cycle. Is inflation rising? Is it falling? Or interest rates rising, falling? Because these are all things that will impact inflation, interest rates, and hence the currency. And I think South Africans understand that very well. You know, I can give you so many examples, but, you know, there's a business in Mexico, which is a Coke bottler. It's a fantastic business, and it's delivered, you know, in Mexican pesos, a good, you know, 8% return over the last 5 years, which is nothing fantastic, but it's not bad either. But if you look at what that's done in dollars, it's you've lost money in dollars. You know, you can construct entire investment cases on good businesses with great management teams, all the things that people talk about when they come on to a show like this and they say, this is the, you know, the stock I want. And you can still lose money in hard currency. So, you know, you really need to understand that if you're going to move into emerging markets with your investments, as an investment manager, you really need to have a view on where that currency is going, because that's where you can lose and make a lot of money.
So when you then zoom out and you look at this world of developing markets, are there opportunities to be had for us in South Africa as people who may be apprehensive about South Africa's, let's go through it, the macros, the regulatory environment, whether or not there really is that much support for investors in South Africa, the vulnerability of the currency. Diversification is the key word. I wonder what your view is on the way in which South Africans should be thinking about behaving with their money.
Look, I think the South Africans' local opportunity set is quite limited. You know, the JSE has done astoundingly well over the past year. And I think many South Africans have breathed a sigh of relief because, you know, things looked rather dark at this time last year for returns. And they've been rewarded quite well. But those returns really have been coming from quite distinctly, you know, concentrated areas. Platinum, you know, resources stocks, and a few other counters have really led the way, and of course, Naspers hasn't helped at all. So, I guess even on purely a diversification argument, the South Africans should be using their offshore allocation, and the investment funds that South Africans are investing in should be using their offshore allocation purely just to diversify away from, you know, the business models we have available here. There's a wide world out there. South Africans are, you know, generally good investors. They're quite savvy, and you can price the risks because you understand. You know, we understand emerging markets. We understand inflation, interest rates, currencies, and I think you can really make some good returns.
What is the lay of the land? The global paranoia at the moment is that the world has been artificially inflated and the world has been supported not only through the global financial crisis, which didn't have any real impact on inflation. It just poured trillions of dollars over a decade into global markets. COVID came along. There was a short, sharp shock. Central banks stepped in once again and boosted markets. And now we're sitting with massive debt burdens on national balance sheets all over the world. We've got inflation beginning to come into the system, transitory or longer term. What is your reading of the state of the world of investing right now?
So, Bruce, I think we've moved into a world where both fiscally and socially there is absolutely no appetite to allow asset prices to fall. You know, you spoke about all the money that's been pumped into the system, that's been printed to support asset prices. Over the last 8 years, you've seen the Federal Reserve try, you know, carefully to lift interest rates, and you know the taper tantrum and all these different things happened, where there's just such an enormous pushback And now there's such a fragility in the system where everything is supported by asset prices. And, you know, interest rates are at rock bottom. So even slight movements there on a percentage basis makes such an enormous impact to the debt loads of corporates and governments and institutions around the world that, you know, we're in a very, very odd space. You know, obviously, you know, the thing that kills bull markets like the one we've been in for, you know, since 2009 is interest rates. It's a very blunt instrument. But what it does is it changes the price of money, it increases the price, and it puts a brake on the economy. It basically stops lending, and with that, it stops everything. So it's a very blunt tool, and it typically leads to recessions, but it is a way of stopping the excesses. Now to get that appetite from the Federal Reserve, I'm simply not seeing it. Even in the latest comments by Powell, there's still talk of a very dovish, gradual rise. We'll have to see inflation manifest, you know, perfectly and way above range before we start raising interest rates. You know, as you know, his view at the moment is still that it's transitory. So, you know, my view is over the next couple of years, we're going to see financial repression, which is inflation, you know, running a bit hot, and in interest rates not compensating for it. So financial repression for your listeners is where you're not compensated via interest rates for the level of inflation.
Does that mean that money then keeps flowing into equities? The money, people keep looking for yield. They keep looking for dividends, and therefore we see more investment into equities rather than bond markets.
Initially, that is exactly the case. But as interest rates start to rise and bonds start to exhibit a more normal pricing, then you'll start seeing more investment into bonds. But that is still some way away. You need to see a proper yield. You need to see the yield on bonds increase above the yield that you can currently receive on high quality equities. And that's not the case. So it's still okay for equities for now. And it's an asset allocator's, you know, a dream
minefield
to be able to use. Well, it's his dream to be able to use more assets, because at the moment, you know, in multi-asset funds, you know, there's this enormous issue where, you know, cash is you know, not giving you any return. Bonds are uninvestable, at least from my point of view, just because of the, you know, the artificial pricing in the bond market on interest rates. So everyone is forced into equities. And for a multi-asset investment mandate, you know, you're looking to find assets that correlate differently and generate long-term returns. It's very difficult. So the dream, as I mentioned, is once again to have assets that can, you know, achieve different outcomes in a portfolio, and that's still some ways off.
Really loved the chat. Thank you, Peter Hundersmark, the fund manager at Flagship Asset Management this evening, headmaster of the Investment School.